As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the game, World Cup Daily from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer and thank you for joining us. Over the next month, we continue to bring you podcasts every match day of the World Cup after 10 o'clock UK time every night. In the studio with me from The Times, it's Mr. James Gearbrandt. And in Volgograd, anxiously awaiting England's opener against Tunisia, it's Jonathan the Darting Don Northcroft. More on that in a moment. Later on, we'll be speaking to The Times chief football correspondent Oliver Kay in Moscow, who has witnessed the biggest shock of the tournament so far. The holders, Germany, beaten by Mexico. And the bookies' favourites, Brazil, have just dropped points too, drawing with Switzerland. But let's start with the England cap, 24 hours away from that first match. Jonathan, good to speak to you. Let's get more on that important issue out of the way first. And the reason that I refer to you as the Darting Don, you played Dele Alli at darts. You kept that quiet on Saturday night.
Oh, Natalie, yeah. I think I'll be haunted by my personal tournament failure for many years to come, just like one of an England player who played Iceland in 2016. I think as people know, the England team have been trying to be a lot more open, accessible and friendly with the media. And as part of that, they've arranged a sort of daily darts competition. We were asked as a Sunday group of journalists to nominate someone. And, well, I have to say, I kind of fancied myself, to be honest. I've played a bit of darts in my time. You know, I thought, okay, they're professional international athletes, but, you know, they might not have my hockey experience. And I fancied it. And I just have to say that I'm afraid, well, an international sportsman had a better mentality than me. I bottled it. I can't put it any other way. I threw 134 in practice and 24 at the real thing.
24.
Dele, who painfully never played darts because he was kind of aiming at the middle of the board, sort of fluked a 25 and went, oh, is that good? He got 53, so it wasn't even a contest. And the journalists are 3-0 down to the players at the moment, and we're now starting to contemplate the horror of a 23-0 whitewash.
hang your head in shame. I think you'll be allowed back into the UK after that. That is disgraceful. But goes to show that competitive action is so very different to practice, Jonathan.
That's it. It's all about, you know, it's mentality, it's mindset. I think I might need Pippa Grange, the England psychologist, to have a strong word with me about things, you know. It was an experience. It was an experience. But fair play to Dele. He was a really nice lad. That was the benefit of doing these things. You kind of get a little bit of a sense of what people are like. He did actually seem a really decent bloke.
Okay. Well, let's get on to matters, England, in that huge game in the Volgograd Arena on Monday night. You've got some news, haven't you, with regards to some mosquitoes. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a local problem here. Volgograd's very hot. It's kind of landlocked. It's very different climate to Rapino, which is, you know, sort of more like being in Scandinavia. It's on the sea. And we've been warned to look out for these mosquitoes, which can be the local mosquitoes are sort of kind of mosquito ultras. They're quite kind of hardcore when they get to grips with you. I mean, I've only been here since this morning. It was quite hot and dry in the morning, and things were fine. But when I went out this evening, I did notice it was a bit of a problem. So, I guess England will have to be sort of sprayed up or whatever to just take precautions tomorrow.
Well, this is what we're hearing, that obviously they will be sprayed with repellent before the match. And the other interesting thing is that organisers are considering using a helicopter to drop a mass payload of repellent over the ground. I mean, that's unbelievable.
I mean, it's certainly leaving nothing to chance. I mean, that kind of makes visions for me of some sort of mosquito army kind of, you know, wondering what their counter tactics are going to be when the helicopter drops us from the sky and they might have a plan for England. But I guess it's one of many things that, you know, we can all kind of speculate about before the game, but when it comes to it, as Dele Alli showed on the hockey, these boys are professionals and they will switch to game mode when they need to be. And even if they're getting bitten by the most violent mosquitoes, they'll probably just crack on.
Indeed. And staying with news on the stadium, the team, so we're hearing, decided against training there before the game. Now, is that usual, or, I mean, would you not familiarise yourself with your surroundings?
Yeah. I thought that was a funny one. I would have expected them to train. It seems to me what they've done is they've prioritised having quality training more than anything else. That's why they went to Rapino, even though Rapino's not really of the same climate of the places that England are playing. I think they went for somewhere that was going to be cool enough and quiet enough to train properly. And I assume that they decided not to train at the stadium because they could get a better session locally. And you know, that was prioritised over seeing the surface beforehand.
By the way, if you are listening to us on Monday morning and you haven't picked up a copy of The Times yet, we urge you to do so. The game pullout front cover has what we expect to be the England lineup, accompanied by photos from their youth. So you're going to have our moments, because there's baby pictures of Jordan Pickford and Kyle Walker, especially cute pictures of those. It definitely is an "ah" moment. But Jonathan, let's focus then on England again. And previously, when England have gone into tournaments, they haven't seemed to know their best system, their best players. But Gareth Southgate, on the other hand, appears to know all that already.
I think one of the strengths that Gareth's got, Natalie, is that in his quiet way, he's very clear and very bold in what he wants to do. And he started rehearsing for the tournament, really, back in October when England had already qualified, and the last qualifier was against Lithuania. He went to the back three. I think he had a clear idea then that that's the way he wanted to go in the tournament, and that was based on 98 World Cup and Euro 96, of which he'd been a part as a player. You know, and here we are. He hasn't deviated from that. It's going to be a 3-5-1-1. I think he knows his personnel. It's impressive to me that he does have this clarity, because we'll remember examples like, you know, Fabio Capello phoning up all these old players on the eve of 2010 and trying to, you know, almost round up a scratch 11 to go in because he suddenly doubted what he already had. We've seen England teams sort of, you know, start with 1-11 and system and then try to find another one during the tournament. I don't think Gareth's going to do that. And I've liked the system so far, but I have to say, you know, there's a lot that seems positive about England's build-up. But the caution would be that, you know, tomorrow will be where we really start to see how good it's been and how sort of valuable all these ideas are.
Harry Kane, of course, going to be playing up top. James, he hasn't scored in a major tournament, but this was going to be a great chance for him to get up and running, isn't it, against Tunisia?
Yeah, it is. It will be really interesting to see how Kane plays, I think, because I think the point has been made ad nauseam that Kane is England's one sort of real world-class player. And I think perhaps more of it, he's England's one real point of strength over some of their rivals. I think when he's at his best, he's a better centre-forward than probably Germany have got, or, you know, some of the other the major nations. The what's interesting about Kane, though, is that he finished the season, I felt, pretty unconvincingly. He picked up, I think, that an ankle injury, and he just, after he returned from that, I don't know whether Pochettino rushed him back in a bit too quickly, but he never quite looked right. He wasn't getting off the same volume of shots that we usually see from him. His all-round contribution and sharpness just didn't seem there. So, you know, we always go through this, don't we? We always go through these sort of it seems that we never get to an international tournament without sort of a nationwide paranoia about one of England's best players. But it will be interesting to see if he's shaken off the after effects of that sort of slightly kind of sort of rusty and kind of clunky end to the season. But, you know, it did appear to be more of a fitness issue than anything else. So if he is back to full fitness, then we may see, you know, the real Harry Kane again.
There's nothing that's absolutely outstanding about Harry Kane. He makes himself a top player by being as good as he can be in all the different sort of categories you'd want from a striker, by being, you know, 8 out of 10 in everything, but he's not 10 out of 10 in anything. And I just wonder that because of that, he needs to be at his absolute maximum physically and everything else to be, you know, the player that we hope he can be. And he hasn't seemed at his absolute best physically since that ankle injury, even though he's scored, you know, the stats suggest he's at his best. I think he's scored something like 9 and 7 since that injury. But your eye tells you that he's not quite the Harry Kane that we know. So that's a big question for me. You know, I think there's the mentality is fine. He will say what he likes. It won't change him. It'll probably fuel him. He knows how to do that. It's physically that I'm looking at Harry Kane and just wondering if he's going to be sharp enough to deliver what he can deliver. And we're not going to know until he's in the heat of battle tomorrow.
Joining us now is assistant sports editor at The Times, Tom Clark, who's been writing our tactical guide to Tunisia. And you can see that online at thetimes.co.uk. We focused on England, Tom, but what tactical challenges do they face on Monday night?
Well, I think Tunisia are a very well-drilled side. They qualified from their group conceding only 4 goals in 6 games, and they were unbeaten. Now, obviously, they're playing against sides that aren't quite up to England's standards in terms of quality, but I think England will have to work very hard to break them down. They will tend to probably sit deep and look to counter-attack. They play with 2 defensive midfielders who will drop into the defence and be all over Raheem Sterling and Dele Alli. They won't get much time on the ball, I would have thought, near the Tunisia goal. And I've looked at whether they might benefit from putting early crosses into the box. In the friendly against Spain, Tunisia struggled with that quite a lot of the time, attackers running into the space between central defenders. So perhaps that's why Ashley Young's been picked for his delivery into the box from out wide. And perhaps Kane and Dele Alli can benefit from those.
We mentioned in the last podcast that it was 3 defeats out of 3 for the African nations at this World Cup. Tunisia are without their top scorer from qualifying, Youssef M'Sakhani, who'll miss the tournament through injury. So what level are this Tunisia team at, Tom?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's definitely a big loss for them. But in the recent games that I've watched, 2 players in particular have caught my eye. There's Naim Sliti, who was very impressive against Spain. He's a similar player to M'Sakhani, very quick, good on the ball, likes to drift in from the wide areas and play off a central striker. So England should beware him. Also, Anis Badri scored 2 excellent goals in the recent friendlies against Turkey and Portugal, both very similar, running onto a loose ball on the edge of the box and brilliant clinical finishes into the top corner. So, yes, they're missing a star man. Yes, they will be very defensive, I would have thought, looking to probably pinch a point, but we should not underestimate them. I think this tournament has shown, you know, particularly with recent results, Germany, Argentina dropping points. I think Tunisia will surprise a few people, I think. And they do have threat going forward.
You've mentioned that their qualifying campaign unbeaten through that, but when it comes to upping their game for a World Cup, it hasn't quite worked out. They in fact have the longest active World Cup winless streak of any side competing in Russia, with no win in 11. So some hope there for England.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think England will be favourites. And as I say, having watched these games, Spain beat them 1-0. You sense Spain were playing in first gear for a lot of it. And I do think England will cause them problems, provided that, as I say, they move the ball quickly, they're confident on the ball. They might need some help from the defence, as I say, to help create space for Raheem Sterling, Dele Alli, to find those little pockets where they could maybe play 1-2s with Harry Kane. And I do think early crosses into the box would be a good way of getting at Tunisia, because they conceded goals from crosses against Portugal. That looked a weakness against Spain as well.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Game, World Cup Daily from The Times with Natalie Sawyer.
You can hear live commentary of all of Monday's games on TalkSport, including South Korea taking on Sweden at 1 o'clock, Belgium versus Panama at 4, and the big one, England against Tunisia, live from 7 o'clock on TalkSport. Let's move on to Rostov. The bookies' favourites to win a sixth World Cup, Brazil, were held to a 1-1 draw with Switzerland in a game where there was limited Latino flair for the South Americans. Is that fair, James?
Yeah, it was quite a disappointing performance from Brazil, wasn't it? I think, coming into the World Cup, I think Brazil were probably the, even among that sort of rarefied company of all the major contenders, they were really the ones where you thought, yes, they're really well-grooved. They are, you know, they've really got a settled system. They know exactly how they want to play. Their results, obviously, have been extremely formidable. And they obviously, as we all know, powered through South American qualifying. But they were quite disappointing. Particularly, I think, Coutinho scored the opening goal. They seemed to lose momentum, allowed Switzerland to have a lot of the play. Obviously, defended one set play extremely poorly for the Swiss equaliser. I just wonder, obviously the system has slightly changed a little bit from what it was in qualifying. It was that very, very ultra-settled 4-1-4-1 with Neymar on one wing and Coutinho on the other. And you had that sort of ultra-pragmatic central midfield of Paulinho, Casemiro and Renato Augusto. And what Tite's done, it's slightly tweaked it and taken out Renato Augusto, who I think has been struggling with fitness a little bit, and move Coutinho from being on the right wing. He's sort of come into that more central midfield position. And I just wonder if that slightly leads to Neymar and Coutinho sort of slightly taking up the same sort of positions, which obviously you didn't get when they were on opposite wings.
It was Switzerland that scored the next goal, obviously, after Coutinho had put Brazil ahead. That came just, 5 minutes or so after half time. Steven Zuber with a powerful header from close range. But there were, first of all, some defensive deficiencies from Brazil. But was there, Jonathan, a foul on Miranda?
Possibly. I think Mark Klamberg's been quite strong about this. To me, it wasn't clear. It was a nudge. I can see why, if the referee is given it, then it's not one of those positions that's clear enough to necessitate changing his decision. We go back to the problem we've got with VAR, isn't it? I don't think it actually does work very well for the marginal calls. We're happy when it's telling you something that's a matter of fact. You know, obviously goal line technology, we've done that in the game, and you're looking for VAR to help you with things like mistaken identity and a handball that's been missed or whatever it is. But with these marginal calls, I think it's just unsatisfying. You know, I think that was probably another example. Maybe Brazil are a little bit unlucky, but I have to say over the course of the game, Brazil weren't as good as I expected. Brazil are my tournament favourites, but Switzerland were a lot better than I thought they'd be. Fair play to them. They were organised, competitive, and believed they could do something.
Switzerland are they're just a very, very solid side. I think in their last 14 games, they've kept 10 clean sheets, and of the four sides that they've conceded against, three of them are obviously Brazil tonight and Spain and Portugal are two of the other three.
Jonathan, just finally, Ronaldo came through Portugal's opener with flying colours. Messi, not so much. And the other of the big three, Neymar, recovering from injury and Brazil's talisman. He started. How did he look to you?
Yeah, not quite at the level that you know, we know that he can be. His performance was certainly more in the Messi category than the Ronaldo category. James is right, probably, that there's always going to be an issue with him and Coutinho perhaps wanting to do the same things on that kind of left channel in a pitch. And they've got to be careful about that. He just looked a little bit like he was a bit slower than Neymar at his best. I think one of his assets is just, you know, a fantastic ability to move the ball at speed, move with the ball at speed, or you know, those quick passes and so on. He's such a fast, fluent player at his very best, and it's possibly the effects of injury and layoff. But he didn't quite look at that sharpness. And of course, he had a couple of opportunities from free kicks, a bit like Messi did, that he didn't take. So, you know, it's early. It's brilliant for us watching these three guys and seeing them all try to push each other and who's going to be the greatest. But I'm reluctant to, you know, make too many judgments on the basis of individual performances. Ronaldo's certainly, you know, he's ahead on the leaderboard from his rivals at the moment, but it's early days between them.
Well, Jonathan, as ever, good to speak to you. Keep up the practice with those arrows, won't you?
See, I fear I'll never get a second chance. That's the problem. That's what tournament football is about. You don't get your second chances.
The Game, World Cup Daily from The Times with Natalie Sawyer.
We'll be giving you a Times trivia teaser question every day on every podcast, as provided by one of the greats in the world of stats, our very own Bill Edgar. We asked you on Saturday, which country has a set of twins in its squad at this World Cup, having had a different set of twins at Euro 2016? Tricky one. Well, the answer is Russia. In Euro 2016, Alexei and Vasily Berezutsky represented the nation. And in Russia right now, it is Alexei and Anton Mironchuk who are part of the squad. So our question for you on Sunday is, which member of Germany's squad at this World Cup was born on the day West Germany beat Argentina in the World Cup final in 1990? Tune in to our next podcast to find out the answer. The World Cup has been lit up by stunning free kicks already, and another from Alexander Kolarov saw Serbia beat Costa Rica in Samara. A classic Kolarov free kick 10 minutes into the second half sealed the points and sent the Serbs top of Group E, as Costa Rica suffered defeat after reaching the quarterfinals 4 years ago. The holders, Germany, suffered a shock defeat at the hands of Mexico in Moscow, and joining us now is Oliver Kay, who watched the game. Oliver, the atmosphere, the emotion in the stadium, it looked incredible.
It really was. I mean, you use the word emotion and the atmosphere. It's been so notable over the past week how many Mexicans, I mean, you've probably heard of Peruvians and Colombians and Argentinians as well, but Mexicans are here in huge, huge numbers. I think a lot of the tickets that were sold in America before the tournament were sold to Mexicans, and they've come in huge numbers. They felt like they've been waiting years and years and years for this, rather than just 4 years since the last one. But they've given the impression that they are incredibly excited about it, like they feel that there's something special unfolding. And God, it really did at the Luzhniki tonight, and the atmosphere was just electric. I've been to so many World Cup games over the years, and it's rarely, you know, it's often quite a kind of corporate atmosphere with all the sponsors and all that kind of corporate tickets. But this was just, it was just wild. It was like being in the Aztec Stadium in 1986. It was just so raucous, so fervent, and they had so much to celebrate. And there was a huge outpouring of euphoria and relief at the end. It was just magnificent to be part of.
A lot of people are going to be very envious of you, because you were at the Russia-Saudi Arabia game, you were at Spain-Portugal. It was a Irving Lozano strike that was the difference in the end between the two teams. So was this the game of the tournament so far for you?
Oh, gosh. I would say Spain 3, Ronaldo 3, maybe on Friday night. Edges it in terms of high quality and high drama, but there was plenty of both with this game. It was a brilliant game, really, and end to end. And Germany probably felt that they could have scored three or four if they'd been a bit more clinical. But the same goes for Mexico. And I'd say it was a brilliant, compelling, absorbing game. And Mexico just deserved so much praise for the way they played. I thought the way they counterattacked with Lozano and Vela and Hernandez was just brilliant. And they, you know, the way they produced their counterattacks, maybe they didn't finish them brilliantly, but no, it was just fantastic.
James, we saw Nigeria being very cagey against Croatia, Australia defensive against France, but Mexico really went for it, didn't they?
I thought Mexico were absolutely superb. And as you say, they came with a real game plan. They found a weakness, that susceptibility to pace on the counter, and they came with a clear game plan to exploit it ruthlessly. They were well drilled, they were cohesive. And I think something that's kind of struck me over the first few games of the tournament is there's been a real marked difference between the sort of what you might call the non-elite teams whose coaches have been in post for quite a long time. So the likes of, obviously, Osorio has been in charge for 2.5 years with Mexico. The likes of Peru, who I thought were very impressive, Iceland, Iran, and those teams where the coaches haven't been in charge for quite so long. You just don't see that same level of tactical cohesion as I think you saw today from Mexico. I thought they were absolutely brilliant.
Ollie, did the Mexico manager, Juan Carlos Osorio, then outsmart Jogi Löw?
I think he did. I mean, he seemed to pinpoint weaknesses, as James said. I mean, the way they pressed Germany in midfield, the way they sort of sucked them into congested areas in the centre of the pitch going forward, and then just blitzed them on the counter-attack, you know, with that pace. Every time Kimmich went forward from right back, left a huge space, and Mexico seemed to find that space very, very quickly. In that respect, there was a sort of similarity to, you know, the way Klopp's Liverpool had played at times, you know, almost bypassing the midfield at times in order to get it forward quickly to the wings, drag the defence this way and that. I thought they were so clever the way they did it, and they had the speed and the skill and the fluency to really stretch the German defence, just not the composure to take more of their chances. And if they'd done that, it could have been. It could have been really embarrassing for Germany.
Inevitably, as we sort of dissect Germany, a lot of people will say, why didn't they take Leroy Sané? Do you subscribe to that, Ollie?
Well, I do. I know when the squad was announced, I think a lot of us Premier League regulars and Premier League watchers were staggered. And I think a lot of the people who had watched the German national team a lot more said, well, you know, he hasn't played great for Germany yet. The strength and depth that they have, Draxler, Royce, etc., is extreme, and that you could rationalise it. But I thought, looking at the way they struggled today to break down a mass defence, well, that's something that Sané's been faced with week in, week out at Manchester City. He has played extremely well doing it. I know it's a slightly different setup, but I think had he been there, had he been in the squad, I think he's exactly the type of player that. That Jogi Löw would have wanted to put on today. So I am surprised. I don't think it's a complete outrage, because the quality of their players is so high. But it does seem questionable. And it was interesting that one of the reporters was saying to him in the press conference, look, you had so many great young players that you brought to the Confederations Cup a year ago. Why are so few of them in the squad? And he was a little bit defensive over that, and suggesting that, you know, there was absolutely nothing wrong with the players he's chosen. And the reality is, of course, he's spoilt for choice, but he didn't seem to get the balance right at all today.
I think what's really interesting for Germany is, what do they do now? Because, I mean, this wasn't just, you know, a sort of... You have those 1-0 defeats where you haven't actually played that badly and there's nothing too much fundamentally wrong. For me, this was not one of those. This was actually quite alarming. Germany was so, so open at times, particularly getting countered through the middle. And Khedira and Kroos just did not look like a kind of... That just did not look like a double pivot that will work. I think Kadir in particular looked miles off the pace. So for me, what's interesting is what does Love do now? The simplest thing is you could put Sebastian Rudy in instead of Kadira. You could move Joshua Kimmich, who has played as defensive midfielder, and put him as the defensive midfielder. One thing that I mean, Love is not reactive at all as a manager. He's not somebody who sort of tends to kind of, you know, overreact to defeats. So I don't think he'll do this, but he could. They won the Confederations Cup playing three at the back throughout the tournament. That would, you know, allow him to give Boateng and Hummels a bit of help. It lets Kimmich fly forward without, you know, with a bit less risk, leaving them less exposed at the back, and kind of, you know, compensates for the fact that they don't sort of have an N'Golo Kante type figure, say, in defensive midfield. I just wonder whether that might be an option.
I think what often happens in these situations where a team starts badly, and I think they often would make one or two sort of small changes or one or two tweaks, no panic, for the second game, and then if things continue to go badly, then you see sort of something radical. Then you see a sort of desperate last throw of the die. And I think if you look at the next two games against South Korea and Sweden, I think most people would expect two wins and most people would expect them to go through. But it does really raise questions about their plan A, and they've spent so long content with that way of playing. And Love was talking about that today. You know, this is how they play, and we're normally very, very good at it. And he seemed not to think there was a reason for mass panic, but I'm sure he will be panicking if they don't win the next game.
Oliver, just finally, after the three thrillers that you've witnessed, what's the game we should be looking out for next? Where are you heading to?
good question. Probably to Russia versus Egypt on Tuesday, but it's all slightly up in the air. We sort of tried to pull one or two ideas together. So probably that. Failing that, it might be Portugal, Morocco on Wednesday, but definitely I will be at Argentina-Croatia on Thursday. So all eyes on that one. It should be another classic.
It certainly should. Oliver, for now, thank you very much.
Real pleasure.
Well, the result in Moscow certainly opens Group F up a little, with the match taking place on Monday afternoon. Sweden versus South Korea, two nations that have been to the last four in the not too distant past. Now, before England's match with Tunisia, their rivals in Group G, Belgium, take on debutants Panama, ranked the third best in the world, and with the talents of Eden Hazard, Kevin De Bruyne and Romelu Lukaku, James, to name a few. This only points for a win, doesn't it, for Roberto Martinez's side?
Yes, I think Belgium are very, very strong favourites for that match. We actually talked a little bit in the preview podcast about how they had a quite weak qualifying group and they've actually faced a lot of quite weak nations in their friendlies, and they've scored a lot of goals. One thing they're very, very good at is running up a lot of goals against slightly second-rate opposition, so I think they will be absolutely fine here. Their weakness is a kind of more question of balance. Are they a bit too gung-ho? You know, are they sort of solid enough against the bigger sides? But I don't think Panama are going to test that, even though they are missing Vincent Kompany and Thomas Vermaelen, and I don't see Panama exploiting that.
That's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, James Gearbrandt, Jonathan Northcroft and Oliver Kay. Subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. For a limited time only, it is just £1 a month for your first 3 months. Search The Times Sale for more information. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast supplier. We'll be back after the final whistle as England open their World Cup campaign against Tunisia.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
and get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.